Jordan Reeves is a 13-year-old inventor from Columbia, Missouri, and she's got quite a resume. Born without the bottom half of one arm, Jordan created a prosthetic arm that shoots glitter. She has started a nonprofit called Project Unicorn. She's even petitioned American Girl, the doll company, to put some limb-different dolls in their collection. Last I knew, their answer was maybe. Jordan's given a TED Talk, make that TED Talks, plural. Did I mention she's 13? When she gave this one, she was 11.
Usually when I meet people, I'll usually hide my arm behind my back, or if I'm sitting down at a table, I'll hide it underneath the table. And that's so people don't judge me off of my difference, and they judge me off of my personality. And I wish that we could change that and not have to have me hide my arm.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. In a new book called Born Just Right, Jordan Reeves and her mom, Jen, talk about their journey so far. Jordan, hello.
Hi.
And Jordan's mom, hi to you too. I know your name is Jen, but...
Yeah, but much more often I'm just Jordan's mom.
So we're going to start with Jordan. Jordan, some of our listeners probably heard from you when you first came out with the glittery prosthetic and came up with the idea of kids having what you call limb difference being what you call unicorns. But that was 2 years ago. And in the life of a 13-year-old, 2 years is basically a lifetime. So I would like to know what's different about the Jordan we're talking to now and the Jordan from 2 years ago, who we just heard in that TED Talk.
I'm definitely less ummy. If that makes any sense.
It does.
But I think I'm more confident, and I'm definitely pushing more into the activism world, which is cool.
Yeah. You were certainly not shy about that 2 years ago.
No, but I think I'm just a bit more confident in, like, talking. I've got more experience.
Jen, would you agree with that?
She's had a lot more experience, yes. And I also think that she is more aware of the impact she can bring into the world.
So what made you guys want to write a book?
Okay, so it was really random. I was coming home from school, and, like, you know that, like, time in the school whenever you're just like, oh, I do like this thing that I've hated all along.
Wait.
Called reading.
So this thing being school?
More like reading.
Okay. I was like, oh, okay. I don't like reading. And then I was like, oh, I do. And wouldn't it be cool if we wrote a book? And it was just really this, like, random thing, and we just did it.
We did it, yeah. We had some folks approach us, and we had already made a pact that we would use the energy and positive work that she's been doing to try to help others. And a book seemed like a really impactful way to do it.
And we can reach more people.
Yeah.
Jen, some of your sections of the book are like blog posts.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about the blog that you've been keeping throughout Jordan's journey and what it was like to sort of look back over those and think about, like, what belongs in the story?
Yeah. So I started Born Just Right, the blog, because, 13 and a half years ago, we didn't have social media like we do now. And so I really had no idea how to help a kid born with a limb difference. I didn't even know that was a thing until she was born. And so I was a journalist at the time. And so I just started documenting the experience. And as I've grown, my writing has grown, my knowledge of supporting and being an advocate for a kid with a disability has grown, and it was really interesting to see how my perspective has evolved through the years, and picking out those moments were tricky.
Can you back up and tell the story of learning that your daughter would have this limb difference?
Well, sure. We didn't know. The ultrasound tech didn't recognize or notice it, which is interesting. She has a pretty short little arm. So she was born, and I noticed it before everyone else. She was baby number two, and she just kind of arrived really quickly. So everyone was like, whoa, there's a baby. And I was like, whoa, where's the hand? And they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, excuse me, where's her hand? And they're like, oh, huh. And I'm like, is she okay? And they looked at me, and they said, yeah, she's okay. And I really immediately knew she was okay. And I looked at my husband, he agreed, and we have had a real positive focus from that point on.
Jordan, when you hear these stories from before you can remember, what do they mean to you?
It's pretty cool to know that my parents were like, oh my gosh, get it away from me.
No, we never said get it away.
That'd be horrible, though.
No, yeah, we didn't react that way. Yeah.
It's just nice to know that they are supportive now and always have been. And yeah, it's nice to also just be able to know things about when I was a baby because I cannot remember that.
You know, Jordan, some of our listeners probably, you know, do remember a lot of this story. But in the TED Talk we just heard, you walked your audience there through some of the ways random people in the world have behaved toward you upon noticing that your arm stops at the elbow. Can you share some of those reactions with our listeners?
So the usual way that happens is I get stared at. So that's a usual thing. Like if you see something that you haven't seen before, you usually would stop and, like, take a look at it and see what's happening. I mean, I know it's a natural thing, but it can make me uncomfortable at some points.
Is there, like, you told a story about being, it sounded like maybe in a food court or something, and that a family that sat near you, that there were three members of the family staring really intensely throughout the meal, which is different from, like, a double take.
Oh, yeah. It was really weird. So we were just eating our macaroons because it was my first time eating them. I know that's just like a fact you guys needed to know. But I was there with my mom and my mom's friend, but also my friend. But like, anyway. And there was this mom, a daughter, and a son. And they're all just eating ice cream and staring at me.
Not even at you, just your arm.
Just like
all three of them.
Eyes locked, not even talking to each other. Their main goal was to stare at my arm. It was really weird.
She even put her arm into a purse to try to get them to break their stare, because we were trying to break their...
It was so weird.
We were trying to break it so we could get our eyes on their eyes and be like, hey, we notice you have questions. We weren't able to ever break that stare. It was wild.
So then staring is clearly one kind of reaction. What are some of the others?
When people try to relate to me and be like, oh, I know someone, my aunt's sister, my aunt's daughter's sister's friend, dog's breeder's is missing her finger.
What does that feel like when people start doing that, like the maybe over relating?
It's really funny because I just love how they're trying to like relate to me, and it's cute because like that's how they like they just saw me and they're like, oh my gosh, that's crazy.
How do I relate?
Exactly. It is I think it's way better than staring or being like a whole oh my gosh.
Which
is that?
It's amazing to me that people do this third one. So yeah, this is one of the reactions you talked about in the TED Talk. People actually just like crying out or like running.
Yeah, a lot of people will just get straight up scared.
More on the kid's side.
Yeah.
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 Or there's just a million questions like, how'd you lose your arm? Oh, I was born with it. How'd you lose your arm? Oh, I was born with it. Also, I get I won't be friends with you unless your arm grows back. That's a recent one.
Wow.
I'm really sad. I really wanted to be friends with that kid.
He was a little. He's a little, though.
But so it's hard enough, I think, for adults to know how to navigate a kind of difference that they're not used to. And then add to that, kids, but then also you're also a kid on the receiving end of people not knowing how to do this.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
What's the right way to do it?
The right way? Oh. I'd say personally, I know a lot of people are curious. It's between the two. Straight up, just get to know me as a person and know my personality and not judge me off my arm. That'd be cool. But also just like ask questions. And I can't say that for everyone because I know I also have days where I don't want to keep on answering questions about my arm.
I'm guessing there are a lot of the same questions, too.
Yes. They're very repetitive, but I get it. But also, it'd also just be great to just be me.
It'd be great if the world just recognized that differences happen.
Yeah.
So I want to get back to your story, which really seems like it changes pretty dramatically at a camp you attended. Can you tell us that story, Jordan?
I have several
camps. Where you came up with Project Unity.
Yes. That one. Okay. So I got invited to go to this camp workshop sort of thing in San Francisco. And it was very just like, why would I do that kind of thing? Like, and there was like, it'd be great if you could come. And we were just like, ugh, fine. And just to think that I might not have done that camp is so weird.
Yeah.
But I went to the camp, and it was a workshop camp where we could design off of our difference. And I decided that I wanted to make an arm that shoots glitter.
Do you remember coming up with this idea? Like, where it came from?
It was so random. I was brainstorming on a piece of paper, and I was, like, thinking undercover, like, agent-like sort of thing. And then I came up with this arm that, like, it's, like, looks like one of those fancy white gloves. I don't even know. But, like, the finger came off, and it's
I'm picturing Inspector Gadget right now.
Yes.
Yes.
It's very much changed from that, and it's way cooler than that idea, not gonna lie. Hmm? It all just, like, and they might not have even had glitter there, and if not for that, it just all came together, you know?
Shooting glitter is pretty dramatic, and you have a story about getting it all over, I think it was your mom.
All the time.
I shoot her every time I have it out. And I know that's really rude. I shouldn't.
Yeah, well.
I love you.
I love you.
Also, once I've got it on my dogs.
Yeah, that is a rule in our house now. You cannot shoot the dogs because the dogs.
Yeah, then it spreads it around the house.
So you did this with a 3D printer, right?
Yeah. I learned how to design on a 3D printer and all that fun stuff. And now I'm enjoying to design and come up with more ideas.
Well, so what did you feel like the first time you wore a prosthetic limb that shot glitter?
It was pretty cool. It's just so weird to think back and just see how I had no clue what was coming.
Yeah.
You know, you talk a lot in your book about being, you say, picky about, like, the fit of a prosthetic limb. Can you talk about that? Because it had not occurred to me that there were different fits, although it makes total sense. Like, everything that you put on your body has to fit.
Yeah. The problem with prosthetics is if they're not comfortable, what's the point in wearing them? Because it just needs to feel good. Good, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and every arm is a different size, and every person has different needs, and so it's very customized. It needs to be very customized.
I haven't been wearing my regular prosthetic in a while because it hasn't been comfortable. Or
you gotta keep inventing new ones.
Keep inventing.
Well, so can you talk about the difference of what you feel like in the world not with your glitter shooting prosthetic and without it?
Well, I usually don't wear it out everywhere. It's more of just like a party thing. Or not really.
Presentation.
I definitely feel more empowered in a way.
You have a strong look in your eye when you wear them. It's like a little persona shift. She goes into, like, superhero mode. She gets real strong looking. If you see any photos of her posing, you can see there's, like, a real strong look every single time that goes on. And even when it was in an early prototype mode, she had this different look.
I have noticed that, which is why I asked. What does it feel like to you as a mom to see that shift? Oh,
I love, well, she's already a strong human, always has been, real strong-willed human. I blame me and my husband for allowing that to evolve. But it's really cool to see her turn it up a notch, if that was even possible. But it always has. From the moment she came up with this idea, she calls it Glitter Girl. It's like a secondary persona when she, sometimes. And we do have, she has drawn out an outfit. We haven't made one, but
that'd be pretty cool.
It would be cool.
So talk to me about the activism piece of it that somewhat grew out of the glitter prosthetic, the Project Unicorn. But it sounds to me like there's more than just that, even.
Well, I've been working in this new area called disability activism, where I am making sure there is more awareness of disabilities and also that things are accessible for everyone. And yeah, making the world better.
So give me an example. Give me an example.
Well, one is paper towels. That's something for me, like, the two-handed paper towels, that's not accessible for everyone. And I've, like, worked on also just straight-up awareness. So also, like, having events, and this book is doing it too.
Yeah.
And I go to events and bring my view of accessibility to the table and make sure that I support what they're doing, but I'm also adding the accessibility into it.
Yeah. So we had to cancel an event earlier this summer because the bookstore that we had it set up, it was not accessible for wheelchairs. And so we really want to be aware of all people being able to be a part of our events. And Jordan's had a chance to work with more youth activists. And when they've been talking about, you know, trying to encourage more kids to vote and more tools to make sure there's more awareness of just the election years and things like that, she's made a point of saying, have you thought about how a person can have an easier time getting to the polling place? Or have you made sure that someone who can see or cannot see as well or cannot hear as well can have access to that information? You know, things like that. She's become aware enough to say, speak up and make sure others are thinking about speaking up as well.
And I'm not perfect on every single disability. I just try to bring the best views that I possibly can.
Right. It's Jordan's lived experience. She can't represent all disability. But I'm really proud of her for, you know, making sure that when she has a seat at the table, that others are able to come to that table with her.
Jordan, can you talk to me about a blind spot you didn't realize you had and sort of learning about that as a person who is limb different yourself and maybe didn't realize that you could be susceptible to some of those blind spots?
I think I've always just been like, I don't know if I can do that. And then it's been in a lot of cases where I think, oh, I'll never be able to do it. And then when I do it, it's just like just a great feeling.
Yeah. When you figure out how to do something that you didn't think you could do?
Yeah.
So that brings me to on your book, on the book jacket, it says on your bio that you can do anything except monkey bars.
Monkey bars are so mean to me and it really hurts my feelings because I always wanted to do monkey bars with my friends, but no, it just doesn't work out.
Just didn't work out.
Okay, well, I do believe that maybe monkey bars will someday be that thing that
someday
you thought you couldn't do and that you will figure out.
We can only hope.
So I want to actually get to, I mentioned this petition you put to American Girl, and I'm curious, I mean, I know the story behind it, but can you share that with our listeners, the personal experience? And Jen, I'd love to hear about this from you, actually, because it's kind of a parenting moment.
Oh, yeah, it was a huge parenting aha moment for me. So Jordan was, I don't know, 4, and we got her a cute little American Girl doll, and I was in one of those modes where I had saved up enough to get an outfit that matched her doll's outfit. And I remember saying something like, how cute you are that you match your doll. And 4-year-old Jordan said, we don't match. She has 2 hands. And I had like a, oh my gosh, I hadn't even thought about it. None of your dolls look like you. And she was four, so I wasn't in any place or headspace to start something. But but we talked through the years after that about how it would be really nice that that dolls that were not just a doll that was handmade, but a doll like a company, a mainstream company, would actually include limb differences, because Jordan would just love for more kids to grow up and have that, you know, that instead of those reactions we talked about earlier, you know, dolls are a really great way to learn about differences. And so we talked about that 3 years, all those years, that 4-year-old aha moment was really powerful for me. And we continued to talk about it for all those years. And
what did end up happening with the petition? You got tons of signatures. They did respond.
They did respond, and a different department at Mattel did reach out to Jordan. And do you want to talk about what came out this year?
Yeah, I got to work with the Barbie team to come out with a Barbie with a prosthetic leg.
Yeah, and we saw it on the shelf at a Target this week. It's really exciting.
So cool.
Yeah,
because it's just the reason why we want it out there is not so I can have a doll that looks like me. That's not the point. It's great just for kids to have a doll like them, but also just for kids without a disability to see it on the shelves and be like, oh, that's cool.
Have it in their doll collection and play with it.
And then see a kid with that, with a limb difference, and be like, oh, that's so cool. I have a doll like that. Like, that's just such a great way to be able to spread awareness.
Your story is so empowering, but Jen, I want you to talk about the blog post included in this book, Mommy, It's So Hard.
Oh. So having a limb difference, and Jordan will tell you now, her shoulder is not in a great place right now. She's unbalanced unless we really focus on core strength, and prosthetic use is a really helpful part of her strength and overall health. And at a certain point, we had to reteach her to walk because she hadn't been using both arms while she was walking. So her entire body was off kilter. And so we were doing a lot of physical therapy. And
I just want to jump in and say you don't necessarily realize that you partly walk with your arms.
Yeah, if you don't walk with both of your arms back and forth, you know, when you your stride is your includes your arms. And so she was her stride was one arm was moving and one arm was staying to the side, and that put her hips off and her legs off. And so during that post was really about physical therapy and how hard that was.
And that was sort of a departure for you, because you had talked not usually about the emotional struggles or the physical struggles, but just about what you were learning, what you were discovering, you know?
Yeah. I'd been documenting through the years the importance of physical strength, core exercises, being healthy. We use prosthetics for her overall all health. And it is worth recognizing there are times when it's not easy.
Whoopsie.
What is important about recognizing that publicly, do you think? Because it's such an empowering thing to come out and say, I can do anything except the monkey bars. And in fact, like, I'm a 13-year-old girl who's got a nonprofit, who's has an invention, who has a book and multiple TED Talks. But there
it's
is still
hard.
This piece of it.
Yeah. We have to admit it. We all need to admit none of us are perfect, and all of us are doing the best we can. So I think along the way, we've always have our bumps and challenges, and being 13 is hard, y'all.
Yeah, Jordan, I mean, you talked about that you would like to be just to be able to talk about things other than your arm. What else does life at 13 look like for you? Tell me about Jordan, the 13-year-old.
It's really emotional.
I remember that.
And dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Remember that,
but
too.
It's fun.
There's fun.
It's fun.
What's
yeah.
Tell me about what's fun.
Just being able to be old enough to wander.
Mm-hmm.
But your friends still want to hang out, sort of, kind of. I don't really know. It's complicated. But, like, it's fun to be at an age to have, like, I don't know, a fun time in some way.
You still don't have adult pressures
Yeah.
Well, Jen and Jordan Reeves, authors of Born Just Right, thank you so much for joining us from Columbia today.
Thank you.
No problem.
And Jordan, I believe you're going to master the monkey bars someday. Never say never, girl.
Someday.
Up next, a Harry Potter-themed band is taking on white supremacy. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away.
When we were young, it felt like a story. The evils in this world simply defeated by my friends and me. But then we grew up, and the world.
This is how a new album from Harry and the Potters begins. It's about the final book in the Harry Potter series, but it is also about politics, specifically fighting white supremacy as Harry Potter might if he had to do it.
When it gets dark, turn on a light. Send out the signal, we must
unite. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we are about to get the story on this from not one, but two Harry Potters, Joe and Paul DeGeorge. They are Harry and the Potters, and they're with me now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for having us
and
here.
And hello again, Paul.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having us.
You guys are in town for a show at the library, but I think we should start from the beginning with the story of how the two of you started Harry and the Potters. It is a nationally known band with a huge following, but also kind of a niche following.
Right. Yeah. As with any sort of fan activity these days, there's people carving out their own niches everywhere. And we were fortunate that we just had this sort of silly idea of putting Harry Potter in a punk band. It was really... By necessity, we were one day throwing a concert in our backyard. A couple bands canceled, and we said, "Well, what if we write these Harry Potter songs we've been talking about?" And
yeah, we always thought it would be fun to see Harry Potter play in a band, and got to have that dream come true one day, and just kept living the dream.
Yeah,
but I want to back up to when you first discovered Harry Potter. You were brothers, as I think we've mentioned, and Joe, you're the younger one, but you were actually first to read Harry Potter.
Yeah, my aunt had given me the books when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and passed them off to my brother after I had read them, you know. All my peers were into the books as well, so.
But then, Paul, you were enough older that it wasn't just like everyone around you was reading them too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think I maybe approached it with a little bit more of like an academic interest. I was in college at the time and just kind of curious what this cultural phenomenon was all about. But yeah, they pulled me in like, you know, everybody else. You know, I don't think there's, while there are books that maybe are initially aimed at children, there's no real age restriction on these books. Everybody's, mm-hmm. Yeah, they captured the imagination of everybody.
So then... You said that you had always thought it would be cool to see Harry Potter in a punk band. Why?
I think that's sort of the culture we were around at the time. Paul was booking all sorts of shows in college, and I was playing in bands as well. And
what was it about Harry Potter and the stories themselves, the themes in the stories, and also him as a character that made you say, this guy's punk?
Yeah, you know, Harry's sort of an anti-authoritarian. There's a lot of instances where he's pushing back on the authority when he can see that...
there's clear injustice.
Yeah, there's injustices.
In the systems at play.
Yeah, and so I think there was that. He also... I don't know. I think it's also the way our brains work, too, which is that we're constantly looking for, these... conceptual things to we have a more conceptual approach to our artistic practice,
but it also feels a little bit like the way siblings just kind of riff.
Yeah,
nonstop.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a big part of what we do is
we're riffers.
Yeah. And it's not our only conceptual band either. We have another band that's about quahogs, which are hard shell clams native to like the northeastern US.
That's where we grew up.
Yeah, so by far and away not our only conceptual based project.
Yeah. I think it's always exciting to see your friend play in a band, and Harry Potter is kind of a character that is a far-reaching friend to a lot of people. I think people grew up alongside Harry Potter, and it's something familiar to be like, oh, I got to see Harry Potter's band.
He's my friend.
He's, yeah.
So this day when you, Paul, have booked a show, I believe in your parents' shed
or something.
Yeah,
that's correct. Joe actually was putting, he was hosting the concert series.
Yeah, I was 14 at the time. And yeah, I booked some of Paul's friends' bands, but they canceled at the last minute.
Flakes.
So in order to not drop the ball on the seven people who were for sure coming to that event, we decided, let's start a new band.
And then you also decided, as it sounds like sort of a spontaneous decision, to both be Harry Potter.
Yeah, there was... Joe looked more like Harry at the time. He was actually 14, 13?
I was 14.
14.
Yeah.
So right about that sort of teenage Harry Potter...
Yeah,
kind of,
but we're brothers. We look well enough alike if you put us in the same clothes.
Yeah, we couldn't figure out what role I should play if Joe was Harry. So two Harrys, you know, time travel. It's all possible.
And then you just like cranked out songs within 24 hours enough for a show?
Actually, 1 hour.
1 hour?
1 hour. We wrote about a half dozen songs and then practiced them for another hour and then played them a couple hours later. And they're not the most sophisticated songs here. I know we're going to be talking about the new record. We spent more than 1 hour on it.
So I how did this go from a small live show happening for, you estimate, 7-ish people in a shed that your parents own to being a band that people everywhere knew about? How did that happen?
When the fifth Harry Potter book was coming out, we were like, well, we have these songs about some of the Harry Potter books, we might as well play them around for people and book some shows in bookstores and libraries around the Boston area, and kind of played through the summer. And then the Harry Potter community online found our music. And from there, our email box was kind of flooded. And
yeah, turns out there's a lot of Harry Potter fans out there. And when
turns out.
We weren't as connected into the fandom until we started getting emails from everywhere.
The fans
around.
Found you.
The fans found us as like, whoa, check out this. And somebody posted, I think, our song Save Ginny Weasley. And and then this was back in the day when you would pay like per megabyte web hosting fees. So when the internet discovered us, I got a $400 hosting bill because people were just downloading our songs off of our website.
You know, I do want to say, I read this recent write-up on you guys in Rolling Stone, and in that article, you point out that music has changed since then, and you're getting at that now, but that it was for you in a real sweet spot where people had this new ability to put whatever they made online, but before all the platforms for it had been corporatized.
Yeah, there was a nice window where, like, the gatekeeping disappeared before, like, the big corporations figured the internet out. And so, we were right there in the – I think that, like, sort of 4 or 5 year MySpace heyday was sort of what really enabled our band to spread.
Sharing music felt much more natural before the algorithm figured out how to do it.
Well, I want to get into the music. Your albums are super fun. So are your shows. I've been to one in Lawrence, and your new album is very much about politics, as we've said. But I've picked an early song to play to show that you started out with just so much innocence and no agenda that I can detect beyond loving Harry Potter. You can challenge me on that if you want to.
Oh, I will.
Okay. But that's for later.
Okay.
Let's start by just hearing this song by Harry and the Potters. It's called My Teacher is a Werewolf.
My teacher is a werewolf. He's liable to bite someone in class. That would be so bad. He's been locked inside the Shrieking Shack. But he's the best dark arts teacher we've had. My teacher is a werewolf.
So, that was My Teacher is a Werewolf by Harry and the Potters, Paul and Joe DeGeorge. And Paul,
so you
you've said, yeah,
the,
you're
yeah,
going
you
to
hear about
me.
The
That's
agenda?
Not, yeah. There's an agenda.
I mean, at the outset, our agenda was definitely like corrupting the youth with the power of rock and roll.
Tell me more about that.
I mean, that's the agenda of rock and roll in general throughout history, is to corrupt the youth, I believe. So that was our goal when we started, was like, we thought it would be fun to play music for kids to be that entry point for them into that world.
And also have like
into
this,
what world though? The world of rebellion?
I think the spirit of amateurism is sort of what a lot of our shows, I think, were exhibiting to children who would come see us at the library. They'd see a sort of music that you're not going to see on TV, or it's just kind of amateurs doing what they love.
It's that punk rock spirit. And yeah, I mean, most, when you get into like children's programming, it's frequently like pretty polished, and we were not that. We were the opposite of that, and we were just going to go out there and do it and convince those librarians to book us regardless.
Yeah, you performed in libraries. You're doing that again, but I also want to say, you know, you got the attention of J.K. Rowling.
Right. Yeah, well, that more than anything is probably due to just doggedly pursuing this project for a long time, if you're out there long enough.
No, I want to say, like, there are so many Harry Potter fan activities that happen that to kind of, like, rise to some level where, like, J.K. Rowling is acknowledging your existence, I think is big.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't honestly know what she thinks of the band, but she did send me a sweet email after I left her a gift once.
What was the gift?
Oh, this is actually a good story. The gift was a trophy of a witch riding a broomstick that I found at the local dump swap shop, and then got inscribed to read to the world's greatest witch. You know, from Harry and the Potters.
Aw. There's been a big gap between your last album and the new one that you're touring the country with now. What was going on there, and what inspired you to take on this new album?
Yeah, we'd made like a few other recordings here and there, but we'd always wanted to write an album addressing the events of the seventh Harry Potter book and the
events such as for non-readers of this book.
Oh, yes. This is really where Voldemort, the evil wizard, has taken power and kind of infiltrated the systems and structures of government and schooling to have a sort of like wizard supremacist, pure blood supremacist power structure that Harry and his friends are fighting a war to take down.
Well, Paul and Joe DeGeorge, we are going to pick right back up with the story of Harry and the Potters with this new album and the message it has for the youth. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking to Harry and the Potters, a band made up of two brothers, Paul and Joe DeGeorge. They're in town with a new album, and they've got a show at the library in Shawnee tonight at 6. These shows are really meant to be training for kids in how to fight white supremacy. Is that right?
Yeah, not just white supremacy, but trying to connect a little bit of the storyline of Harry Potter to our own culture and socio-political situation, you know, maybe using the show or our music as an entry point for parents to start having conversations with children about these issues. 'Cause I think part of the problem is a lot of these things like white supremacy are really systemic and ingrained in our culture. And I, you know, frequently we will hear people say like, that might be a little bit of an advanced topic to cover with children. And I think part of the problem is that we're not maybe talking about these things earlier on, and that's how they become
ingrained.
Yeah, they're things we have to unlearn later as we get older because no one talks about them to their children.
Talk to me about the message of the album. If you could say there's a message, what is it?
Yeah, well, the album, the first clip you played is from the lead track Lumos, and I think that that's sort of like the mission statement for the album, which is that it actually, that song ends with a direct sample from Elie Wiesel's Nobel Prize acceptance speech in 1986, maybe.
But he was an author who wrote about the Holocaust.
He wrote about the Holocaust, and the sample we pulled from that essentially is, it's frequently quoted, but it says, there is no neutrality in when oppression is present. Either if you're silent, you are aiding the oppressors and not the oppressed. And so that's the mission statement of the album, which is like, hey, if you see injustice, you must fight against it. Otherwise, you aid it.
I want to play a song from Lumos. This is called The Trace. It's by Harry and the Potters. What this song is about from both a Harry Potter standpoint and a Politics Today kind of standpoint.
Yeah, the Trace is a method that the wizard surveillance state uses to track underage wizardry. So we have a line like, why are they worried so much about wizard teens? Just, you know, practicing magic on their own. Outside of the supervision of adults, but it's used in the stories to track Harry Potter and used to like punitive measures for him when the administration and powers at the ministry have an agenda against Harry Potter.
Right, it gives them leverage over Harry Potter because they've been tracking his activities as a wizard.
What do we learn from this?
If you're looking for the contemporary take on it, I think we're headed. We are in a time of massively increased surveillance, and that's not just from a state level, but also, you know, private companies watching what we do online at all times. And so, I think what we're just seeking to highlight is the extent of that in our daily lives, and you know, part of combating that, the solutions to those problems need to come from regulations and things like that, but we're not going to get there unless there's a massive awareness of what's going on. And that's only starting to come out with regard to the way like social media companies are really tracking every single thing we do.
Yeah, there's a line in the song that says, in times of peace, it seems like overreach in times and opens the door for misuse in times of war. And, you know, I think we see that sort of, that power dynamic in so many places, especially with like ICE doing mass deportations of people and the surveillance of communities of color in this country. It's something to fight back and push back against.
A line that intrigues me is that spell you cast, don't let it be your last.
Yeah. The idea that
that's about the taboo, which is another method of tracking wizardry, where if you say a certain word, they can find out where you are. So like Voldemort's name ends up being a taboo.
Yeah. I mean, the trace can be used to essentially like detain people. And so if you get caught, then you could end up in prison, Azkaban, potentially.
Well, okay, so I want to move on to another song, and this song is The Banality of Evil. Talk to me about The Banality of Evil as a concept, and then we'll hear The Banality of Evil, the song.
Sure. The Banality of Evil as a concept is straight out of the Holocaust again, where I think whenever we have mass atrocities, it's very easy to point to the people at the top who sort of started or popularized those ideas and concepts that caused harm to people. But there's a whole system of administration that unfolds in order to make those atrocities happen. And so the banality of evil was kind of a way to describe the complicity of people in essentially administering an atrocity like the Holocaust. And in the context of the song, we're looking at a specific instance where Harry sneaks into the Ministry of Magic. He uses a Polyjuice potion and is for a few hours spends the day as a man named Albert Runcorn, who wasn't outwardly a Death Eater, but he was very clearly complicit in perpetuating these abuses of power, where he was setting up wizard families to be separated. In the instance there that happens in the books, he was, I think, falsifying information about a wizard's genealogical history so that they would be targeted for essentially detention.
Had they done 23andMe?
I don't know what the wizard equivalent of that is, essentially.
But. Okay, let's give it a listen. The banality of evil.
Do you want to be a death eater today? Runcorn. Do you want to be a death eater today? Runcorn. Sending you home.
Find in performing songs like this for now a couple of generations of Harry Potter fans? Do you see generational differences in what people get from, like, this song or some other of the more overtly political tunes?
It's hard to know right now how people are responding or what impacts these songs are making. I mean, they go over great in the show, but I don't know what the lasting impact is just yet. But I do know that Harry Potter fans, by and large, this work has really impacted their lives and helped shape their morality in a lot of ways, and made them, you know, these, J.K. Rowling has said these works are a prolonged treatise on tolerance. And I think we see that emerge out of what you might call the Harry Potter generation, which is that they are more committed to those things and more committed to fighting against injustice.
Yeah, they have great role models of that are characters in the books for that's sort of like a roadmap for how to behave as an activist.
You both play Harry Potter, but who are, like, if you're looking at the whole Harry Potter crew, is there one member of it, that crew in particular, who, like, is your activist role model personally, or all of them?
I mean, they all do their own parts, but Hermione is a great leader among the students to kind of have the foot first in the door in organizational efforts. Like, she creates SPEW, the Society for the Promotion of Elvish Welfare, and is the lead organizer of the basically student union that is Dumbledore's army that pushes back against a sort of bureaucratic invasion of.
So she's working within the system.
Outside. These are kind of activist organizations outside of the system.
Gotcha.
And she's, yeah. That's.
Yeah,
you guys were really upset at that notion.
No,
because she specifically in the last Harry Potter book, when the Minister of Magic comes and says, you know, you'd be great. Have you considered a career in magical law? And she specifically says, no, I'm hoping to do some good in the world to the Minister of Magic, the sort of representative of the establishment there.
Before we go, I am guessing you've seen the whole read another book meme where people online, when someone's obsessing over the meaning of Harry Potter, they get shot down with read another book. What do you say to that mentality?
I say, give me a book recommendation, because that's not productive to shut down something people are really engaged by and interested in. Why? What's the harm there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paul and Joe DeGeorge, Harry and the Potters, thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
These guys have a show tonight at the Monticello Library in Shawnee. It starts at 6. They'll be performing Lumos and teaching kids how to be activists, good citizens, however you want to label that. That's a wrap for today's show. You can listen back to anything from this hour at kcur.org/centralstandard. It'll be online by the end of the day. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you can talk to all of us on the team on Twitter. We are at kcurcst. Up to date is next. Don't miss it.